Welcome. This is James Corbett of The Corbett Report and now of FukushimaUpdate.com. And today I am honored to be joined on the line from the United States by Arne Gundersen, a 39-year veteran of the nuclear power engineering industry and a former senior vice president in the nuclear industry, who has experience managing and operating 70 nuclear power plants across the United States, and who has also helped to write the co-author the first edition of the Department of Energy's Decommissioning Handbook, a veritable fount of information on the subject of nuclear power. Arne Gundersen, it is a pleasure to have you on. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Well, thanks for having me and welcome. Good morning from Vermont.
Well, welcome from Japan. Good evening from Japan, I should say. Okay, well, it's great to talk to you. And so let's get straight into some of the latest developments with Fukushima, obviously, something that everyone's concerned about right now. We have a lot of worrying news regarding new hotspots that are being discovered in Tokyo and other such developments. What can you tell us about the latest about what's happening there?
We're also aware of actually more hotspots than are being publicly discussed. I'm not sure that all of the hotspots are new. It's likely that as people begin to look, they're going to find hotspots. It's pretty clear that Tokyo got hit with a large amount of radiation sometime in the first 2 weeks after the accident, and some of that is definitely coming from that time period. But interestingly, we just got some data in here that shows that air filters on houses in Tokyo that have actually seen an increase in radiation in the last month compared to 2 months before that. And that could not have happened from the first Fukushima blast. I think what's happening is that the incineration of waste around Tokyo and around Japan is revolatilizing the cesium, and therefore you're beginning to see it again, and it's creating new hotspots. So the hotspots are both old and new. The new ones concern me more because it's revolatilizing it, and it's no longer just on the ground. We're seeing this on air filters that were replaced a month ago. And so to see that is an indication that the cesium is now airborne again.
Extremely worrying. Well, how about the latest announcement from TEPCO that apparently they're going to be able to achieve cold shutdown a month earlier than expected? What does that really mean?
Cold shutdown is an industry term, and it means that the nuclear reactor is below 100 C, and but it also means that the nuclear fuel is in the nuclear reactor. Remember, the pellets are about the size of my finger joint, and they're in long tubes that are 4 meters high, and there's thousands of these tubes. So if the water in a normal reactor is at 100 C or less, that means that that long tube is essentially at 100 C or less too, and hence, in a normal reactor, that's what cold shutdown is. I think TEPCO is applying it as a misnomer to claim that Fukushima 1, 2, and 3 are in cold shutdown. What they mean is that the water is at 100 degrees C, but if the reactor has melted down, and it certainly has melted down, that really means that the molten mass at the bottom is not at 100 C yet. You know, there was a video out about 2 weeks ago, a TEPCO video out about 2 weeks ago, that had a cloud of smoke coming from inside Unit 2, and a separate video had a cloud of smoke coming from inside Unit 3. That's steam. And the problem there is that clearly shows that the containments have not retained their integrity. That there's a leak in the containment, and they shouldn't be steaming if you're in cold shutdown.
Certainly not. So what do you think is the next step in this process for TEPCO and the Japanese government?
I think, you know, what they've been able to do, and it's a good thing, on Unit 1, they have the tent in place, and that's a good thing. What they'll do now is connect that tent to large air filters and then run it up the stack. So in the next month or so, they'll get be able to clean the air from unit one. I think the next reactor to do that on is probably unit four, and then unit two. Unit three is such a mess. I have a hard time believing I could put a tent over it unless they remove all that rubble first. But what TEPCO means by cold shutdown is they've been able to draw the water out of the bottom of the nuclear containment, filter it through that Areva system, and pump it back in. They have to filter it first because it's so radioactive, it would crap up the pipes and the pumps and expose workers needlessly. So then they've got this highly radioactive filter. The Areva filters are becoming highly radioactive, more radioactive than any filter in any power plant that's ever been operated. So we've taken a problem and kicked the can down the road a little bit. We've taken the highly radioactive water and made it less radioactive and are now pumping that back through the reactor. Every loop it does that, though, it's in contact with the raw nuclear fuel, so it becomes contaminated again. So those Areva filters are becoming highly, highly radioactive. And the next question for the Japanese is, what are we going to do with those filters? There's never been an experience of disposing of filters that are that radioactive within the nuclear industry.
Well, that does not sound particularly pleasant, so that's unfortunate. But let's turn our attention now to some a little bit larger, broader issues, looking at Fukushima and really what it all means. And I wanted to use as the basis for that conversation a video that you put up on fairwinds.com recently, "Are Regulators and the Nuclear Industry Applying the Valuable Lessons Learned from Fukushima?" which I think is an extremely good question to be asking at this point. But of course, that question in itself, before we can even start asking it, I think begs the question, what are the lessons from Fukushima?
In my opinion, the big issue is Mother Nature can throw something at us that we have we simply cannot protect against. And and it's not just the tsunami at Fukushima, it was also the earthquake at Fukushima. Both of those were beyond design bases. And in the States, we had a flood in at Fort Calhoun on the Missouri River, and we had an earthquake on the East Coast at North Anna. All four of those events in a six-month period all exceeded the design bases. So the question for continuing operation of existing plants and for building new reactors is, have we really set the bar high enough to protect these things? And it's an economic decision. This isn't pro-nuke, anti-nuke. This is about money. If the bar is set too high, then nuclear power becomes too costly. So the discussion has to be, where do we set that bar and whose experts do we believe? TEPCO had its experts saying an 8-meter tsunami wall was just fine. But there were other experts in Japan who said, no, in fact, the 15-meter tsunami that hit Fukushima was probably not the worst. So when there's a profit motive and you've got the likelihood of a severe event happening not too often, but still when it hits, it's severe. As a society, we're not used to dealing with these low probability, high consequence events. And it's a little bit worse than that because the last 6 months have shown that they're really not low probability events. I think the first and most important lesson from Fukushima is to reevaluate, are we really, as a society, designing these plants for what Mother Nature can really throw at them?
Well, that's a very good question, and it does, I mean, raise the question, because in just about any other field of engineering that you can think of, there's always a huge safety factor that's factored into these things. We don't hear about skyscrapers just collapsing on themselves every day, because these are engineered with a 10 times safety factor and obviously over-engineered, and to think of all of the incredible accidents that have occurred in nuclear power plants in the last 6 months, I mean, it does seem to indicate that there's something very much lacking in the regulatory framework that as it exists today, doesn't it?
And again, the consequences of a nuclear reactor are much worse than the consequences of a skyscraper collapsing. So if we decide as a society that we want a 10-fold margin for a skyscraper, then perhaps we need a 100-fold margin for a nuclear plant, because although it's low probability, it's high consequence. And that's the message that decision makers are not getting. You know, as soon as the price starts to go up, the answer is, well, we need to drop the margin. And I don't think that's a good idea. On new nukes now, not the existing nukes that have already been built, but on new nukes, the threshold between solar and other renewables and the cost of a new nuclear unit has already been crossed. And Fukushima has probably added 10% to that. So we're already seeing the nuclear prices going up and the solar prices going down. And I think that an event like Fukushima will drive that point home on new nukes. The question is, what do we do about the 450 operating reactors that are already in place? Is it worth spending the money to increase their margins of safety? Now, one of our videos, Maggie and I were walking before Fukushima, 3 weeks before Fukushima in February here in Vermont. Maggie and I were walking, and she said, you know, we find a lot of things wrong. Where do you think the next nuclear accident is going to be? And I said, I don't know where, but I know it's going to be in a Mark I, which is what Fukushima was. That was known to the industry, but yet allowed to happen. It was known to TEPCO. It was known here in the States. Worldwide, we knew that Mark I reactor didn't have the margin that the Mark III reactor had, for instance. And we need to go back and look at these old designs and say, you know, have we really put the appropriate safety margin into them?
Well, obviously a very important question to be asking, and it also begs another question which you raise in your video, which is who's in charge, which I think is a very good question to be asking, and perhaps we can take a look at the Fukushima situation to ask who's in charge there, and if something similar were to happen in the U.S., I mean, is there a clear, formal, documented plan for who would be in charge in that situation?
You know, I think that's really important. In Japan, it seems to me like the priority of TEPCO was TEPCO first, the government of Japan second, and the people of Japan third. They were on the first several days of the accident. I think in the back of senior management's minds, they were still planning on starting these units back up, and hence the argument over whether or not to put salt water in. I think the plant manager clearly understood that the situation was out of control. He had lost the unit and he needed to put salt water in. But yet TEPCO at senior levels was clearly thinking about restarting that unit up. Same thing happened on Three Mile Island. I studied that, and management said, well, you know, in a week or so, we'll get this thing started up again. Whereas the plant manager knew how serious it was. Anyway, who's in charge in Japan? It has seemed to me for a long time that Tokyo Electric had more power at the table than did the Japanese government. Now, perhaps the Japanese government is slightly worse than here in Japan, but here in the U.S., but really not a whole heck of a lot. Here in the U.S., we've got the industry trade group NEI. And when they come to the table, they carry a lot of political weight. The Congress has never approved a commissioner who NEI, the nuclear trade group, didn't approve before it got to Congress. So there's I don't think the people of Japan should be feeling as if they're unique, that TEPCO had a a stranglehold on the government of Japan that didn't happen elsewhere in the world. It is happening here in the U.S., and it's a concern. I also believe it happens in France and also in China.
That's a remarkable fact, and I wasn't even aware of that. So there has never been a nuclear commissioner who has not been approved beforehand by the industry itself. I mean, what does that speak to the relationship between those the industry and the regulators that are supposedly watching over them?
Actually, I shouldn't say never. Since 1994, so for the last 17 years, there hasn't been a commissioner that hasn't been vetted by the Nuclear Energy Institute. You know, we had a senator here, Pete Domenici, from Arizona or New Mexico, and he wrote a book about how he forced the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to be more industry compliant. He met with the head of the the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, it was a woman at the time, and she said that Shirley Jackson, and she said that he forced her to speed up licensing because he threatened to cut the budget and in half. And he actually brags about that in his book. So this is not something that's unknown to the public. It's actually in print. We've also seen it recently. There's a Commissioner Merrifield who, while he was a commissioner, his time on the commission was winding down. He went looking for work, and he contacted on his personal office phone the people who he was regulating, and he said, "Hey, I need a job." After he got a job, he made decisions as a commissioner that favored the company he was going to work for. So this is not a situation unique to Japan. This is a situation that's global. Barry Commoner had an expression years and years ago, back in the 60s or early 70s, and he used the term a nuclear priesthood, and it has become that. You know, with the people that run these reactors seem to think that the public has no opinion that's reasonable in the long-term decisions about nuclear safety. And when they don't get their way with the regulator, they run over to Congress and apply pressure. And the same thing was true at TEPCO.
Well, I suppose that isn't really surprising for a public that has long become used to the revolving doors in so many aspects of the government, from the former Treasury Secretary being Goldman Sachs and all sorts of revolving doors, Monsanto and other such things. But it's particularly worrying when it's dealing with something as sensitive as nuclear safety. And that raises the question, I guess the twin questions, of how this has come to pass in the first place, and then what can actually be done about this relationship.
Wow. I think there's a book there. if you go back to how it began, you know, clearly this all started because of the weapons program. And we had a technology in place, gaseous diffusion for enrichment, that had other applications. So it went into the nuclear navy, and then from the nuclear navy, it went into commercial power plants. There were other decisions that could have been made back in the 1950s and 1960s that might have resulted in a safer nuclear power plant, but it wouldn't have been a uranium-based enriched uranium plant like we have in Japan or like we have in the United States. But the decision to go with the type of plant we have was driven because to build our weapons, we needed the gaseous diffusion enrichment plants. So we are where we are. The plants are the plants are good. This issue of decay heat, when the uranium atom splits, these pieces remain highly radioactive. That issue would not have been as significant had the industry done other alternatives years ago. Now, I think to answer your question succinctly, it boils down to money. Wall Street in the U.S. is not funding new nukes because they're way too expensive, and we're relying on taxpayer guarantees. And And an event like Fukushima pushes up that threshold even higher. I think it's not about being pro-nuke or anti-nuke. It's about, does the money make sense? And when you properly look at the risks and the financial risks, I think that more and more boards of directors are going to make the decision that there's got to be another alternative out there rather than to build a new nuclear plant.
Well, I think you're right. It's certainly going to become an economic decision, and we've seen signs of that already. For example, Sellafield in Britain is apparently stopping its MOX production because the Japanese demand just isn't going to be there in the wake of Fukushima. How else do you think Fukushima is going to play out in the near term? And then in the long term, I mean, do you think there is room left for a nuclear industry, or will it wither away as the economics of it makes it basically unfeasible?
I hope that the Japanese physicians accurately measure and monitor and report the health effects that will occur after Fukushima. I firmly believe that there'll be over the next 20 years, a million additional cancers in Japan as a result of the Fukushima incident. Now, whether or not that gets properly recorded is my, personally, my biggest concern, because I think government pressures will want to downplay that and industry pressures will want to downplay that. We saw that at Three Mile Island. We saw that at Chernobyl. The difference here is that we do have the internet now, which we didn't have, 30 years ago when those accidents occur. So I think as that information gets out over the next 5 years, there would be an increase in thyroid and lung cancers. And out at about 10 years, you begin to see the organ cancers. As that information gets out, I believe that that'll factor into decisions on new nukes on a on an emotional level. But the industry has already acknowledged in trade magazines that they're expecting a 10 to 20% increase in cost. Now, here in the States, an old nuke, that one that's been running now for years, has at most cost $1 billion. And for my Yankee, cost a couple $100 million. And now that same nuclear plant is costing $20 billion. So the capital cost is somewhere between 10 to 50 times higher than the cost that we were used to for nuclear power. So the argument that nuclear power is cheap may have held true for these 440 plants that are operating, but it doesn't hold true for the new plants. Then when something costs $20 billion and when it breaks, it breaks for good. It's not like a coal plant. And when a coal plant breaks, it may kill one or two workers, and in 3 weeks you've got it running again. When a nuclear plant breaks, it's down for forever. So the risk of an accident are significant, and the capital cost is enormous. When that happens, it seems to me that I think boards of directors are going to look for alternatives to that way to generate power.
Well, as you mentioned before, the costs of alternative sources of energy are decreasing, even as the nuclear costs are increasing. And it is interesting to watch how this will play out. What do you think in the long term alternative sources of energy might be that could potentially replace nuclear power?
Well, I think we're going to see distributed generation. Back in the 20th century, seems so far away, the only way to really generate electricity was with central station power. So we had larger and larger central station powers connected by transmission lines. The computers allowed us to go with a distributed generation and smart grids. For instance, if you have a wind and you have a country as large as Japan, the wind may not be blowing in one area, but it's blowing somewhere else. And years ago, back when nuclear plants were made, there was no vehicle to transfer that power easily. But computers have allowed us to have a smart grid so that we can transfer power north to south or east to west much easier. The other piece of that is that we have means of generating power now that are much smaller and localized. Now, it can be solar on a house or individual windmills, but the other possibility is gas in something called a bloom box. And that's a device no bigger than a pickup truck, and it generates about a megawatt. And it can be placed in your neighborhood. But so that's cool there are no transmission losses, and transmission losses account for about 10% of all power. So that's neat that it's right next to the load. But the other thing is that it's 80% efficient, whereas that nuclear plant is 30% efficient. So so the net result is, for less impact on the environment, you're creating 2 to 3 times more power. So I think that we're going to see distributed generation with renewables, and the bloom boxes are driven by gas, and less of these central station power plants as the century moves on. You know, I've used the analogy before. We seem to be fighting the last war with these large central station power plants. It reminds me a lot of the French when they built the Maginot Line after World War I. That was a great idea to prevent World War I from happening, but it didn't stop World War II. And the same thing holds with these large generating plants. Technology has changed, and so has cost. And the net effect is, I think, with distributed generation and with smart grids, we'll be able to move that power around so that we'll be able to do without central station power by the end of the century.
That is a very hopeful thing, and something that we have to be, I think, aiming at. But as you pointed out, this is about economics, and there is a nuclear priesthood that is developed. Obviously, there will be a great deal of resistance to these types of changes.
You're absolutely right. I think the difference after Fukushima is that while the priesthood may want nuclear power, Wall Street and Main Street do not. Now, I don't think it matters if Main Street wanted it. If Wall Street wanted it, it would happen. But we're seeing within the investment community a lot of trepidation here about whether or not to fund an investment like this. If they can throw it onto the backs of the consumer, that's one thing. But if they have to bear the cost themselves, that's another. And I think in Japan, that same thing's happening. You know, that it seems to me like the government of Japan does not want to admit that this problem is going to cost $250 billion U.S. So we're talking 100 times that in yen. In order to do that, it will cause TEPCO to be bankrupt, and I don't think anybody's willing to take that step. And until the government of Japan recognizes the magnitude of this, and the investment community realizes that an enormous utility is going to be brought to its knees, we're going to have these haphazard, sporadic attempts to mitigate the radiation, as opposed to a coordinated plan.
Well, an absolutely fascinating topic. Finally, Arnie Gunderson, please tell us a little bit about Fairwinds and the work that you do there.
Well, Fairwinds and Gunderson both have an E in them. Maggie started Fairwinds in 2003. I joined full-time in 2008, but we've done nuclear consulting for states like the state of Vermont and other states, for non-governmental organizations and for individuals for years and years and years. After she had always told me, why don't you do videos on the site? And because I'm a teacher, I also teach at the community college. And after Fukushima, I wound up on CNN and other stations, and they weren't giving me enough time to tell all the information that needed to get out there. So I said, all right, let's do a video. And our traffic before Fukushima on a good day was 80 hits a day. And now, since Fukushima, we've had 7 million visitors, not just on our site, but other people have downloaded it. So really the Mr. Science videos have changed the public's perception of Fairwinds. But we make our living by doing expert reports for non-governmental organizations. And all the TV and all the website work is for free.
And how can people support you if they want to, for all of the incredible work you've done on this issue?
Thank you for the compliment. There's a donate button on our site. If you're getting Fairwinds from another site, and we encourage other sites to download it, but if you're getting Fairwinds from another site, you got to go back to the Fairwinds site, and there's a PayPal donate button, and we would certainly appreciate a donation.
Well, as I think all of my listeners will probably be well aware, you've been doing a lot of incredible work on the subject, so my hat's off to you for that, and thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today about this very important subject.
Thanks for having me.